313-673-4207. That's 313-673-4207. Or visit online at www.DearbornFarmersArtisansMarket.com.
Ranger Station.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting in the forest.
Uh-huh.
1 second I'm having a smoke. Next thing I know, I'm face-to-face with Smokey Bear.
Wow.
And he told me it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
Did you know 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans?
I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous and you're not. Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. We leave no warrior behind. Wounded Warrior Project is a nonprofit organization created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war. Whether those scars are physical or mental, we're here to make sure that they heal. And whether it's helping those with post-traumatic stress disorder live a normal life again, or giving much-needed support to injured warriors and veterans hospitals. Because no one deserves our help more than the men and women who risk their lives to keep us safe. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Dr. David Jacobs, Ph.D. Dr. Jacobs is the director of the International Center for Abduction Research. He is associate professor of history at Temple University, specializing in 12th century American history and culture. In 1973, Dr. Jacobs completed his doctoral dissertation in the field of intellectual history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on the controversy over unidentified flying objects in America. This was only the second Ph.D. degree granted involving a UFO-related theme. Now, he has researched the UFO phenomenon since then, specializing in alien abductions. He has conducted nearly 900 hypnotic regressions with over 140 abductees. He is the author of Secret Life, First-Hand Documented Accounts of UFO Abductions, and The Threat Revealing the Secret Alien Agenda and UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge. And we are privileged to have him with us on the line today. Hello, Dr. Jacobs.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Good.
And you have been studying the abduction phenomenon since when?
Well, I started studying the abduction phenomenon in 1982, but I didn't start doing my own primary research, that is, hypnosis with abductees, until 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've been studying the UFO phenomenon since I was an undergraduate at UCLA since the mid-60s.
Oh, I see. So you're a history professor. Are you retired? Are you still a professor there? Or?
I am enjoying my retirement as of a week ago.
As of a week ago?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. So you were a history professor anyway. And
I
how,
used to be in the distant past.
In the distant past. As of last week.
Right.
I see. Okay. Well, hey, time flies, doesn't it? How did you get involved with the UFO phenomenon being a history professor?
Well, I really don't know how I got interested in it as an undergraduate. I was just got interested in it in some way or another. When I came to teach at Temple University in Philadelphia in 75, a member of the American Studies program asked me to teach a course on UFOs in American society, because there is a fairly lengthy public history to the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught that almost on a yearly basis from 77 until last semester, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I kept up my interest in UFOs, and then when I became interested in abductions through the work of my colleague Bud Hopkins, I realized that the abduction phenomenon was the UFO phenomenon, at least that's my opinion, and I began to study it much more intensely than one ever can study UFOs, because with the study of UFOs, you're basically looking at the outside shells of objects and characterizing their behavior, and there's not a lot you can learn about motivations and goals and purposes and things like that. Whereas with the abduction phenomenon, you can learn that. Now, learning that, of course, means using hypnosis, which has all sorts of problems, and it's based on human memory, which has all sorts of problems as well, and you don't have the kind of hard evidence that the UFO phenomenon has. There's no photographs, motion pictures, videos, there's no sound equipment, there's very little other than people's anecdotal evidence, that is given through hypnosis. So it's a pretty weak form of evidence, but it is evidence, and I'm still doing it.
Well, the under hypnosis, correct me if I'm mistaken, but under hypnosis, the conscious mind is set aside, and the subconscious mind is addressed. And, not really.
No, people are conscious. They're thinking about the questions that are being asked to them. They're remembering. They're focused in. They're remembering much more, particularly in the first couple of sessions. They censor themselves so much. They'll think to themselves, gosh, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened. I'm not going to say what I see up there. That's just too crazy. And
right.
I'm not going to say this, and I'm not going to say that, because you'll think I'm nuts.
Mm.
And it takes a while for them to just sort of relax and begin to stop self-centering, censoring.
Right.
If they want, they can get up, they can go to the bathroom. They talk with me normally, during the hypnosis session and all that. They'll ask me questions. And so the form of hypnosis I use really is just relaxation techniques. And,
right, right.
For the most part, although some people really have profound abreactions, they really are at the place. For the most part, they just remember it, and they keep remembering it. And the more hypnosis that they go through, the easier it is for them. But they're always self-aware, and they're never, they're not blurting out the intimate details of their personal life or anything like that.
The old making somebody act like a chicken is simply Hollywood, right?
Right. Well, that's stage hypnosis,
right.
and what that involves is people who are extremely vulnerable. You get up on stage, and there's the hypnotist who is really good at this kind of type of work, and make them think that they're a teapot or a chicken or a plank or board or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that will last for about 15 minutes or so, or 10 minutes even. Most of the time, though, most hypnotists just try to get people to stop, professional hypnotists, that is, to try to get them to stop eating, stop smoking, or relax, you know, to relieve stress. Those are the big three, essentially. And in order to even do that, they have to come over and over and over and demonstrate a real commitment to it as well and everything.
Right, right. Is hypnosis really, you know, can it be relied upon?
Well, it can be, and there's forensic hypnosis, and there's dental hypnosis. There's all sorts of things that have certain degrees of reliability. Mm-hmm. People do remember things. As a little side thing, I've helped people find things every once in a while. One person had written a paper and couldn't find his paper, and another person had lost his wallet and had no idea where it was, and both times it was successful to my absolute amazement.
Really? But you were amazed at it, huh?
Yeah, you know, because I don't do that kind of stuff. All I do is just abduction hypnosis, which is extremely difficult, extremely difficult. Yeah. You have to know what the abduction phenomenon is. You have to know what questions to ask. You have to know how to interpret the answers. People say things from time to time that are not true, although they think that it's true. And there's all sorts of techniques in this. But hypnosis is pretty close to being not exactly fraudulent, but it doesn't work the way people think that it'll work. Whereas people walk around like zombies or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Spell, you know.
Yeah,
that's certainly not been in my experience.
Right.
And I've done actually about 1,100. I looked at about 1,100 different abduction events.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at about 1,100, over 1,100 abduction events through hypnosis, and I've never had that kind of a problem, you know. Mm-hmm. However, it's tough because most people who are hypnotists can't do that, or hypnotherapists, they can't do it. They don't know anything about the abduction phenomenon.
Right.
They don't know anything about confabulation. They don't know anything about how to ask questions. And everybody who comes to me who has any knowledge of the society whatsoever knows two things. They don't want to be led, and they don't want to pick up stuff in popular media, popular culture, and then parrot it back to me as if it came from them.
Right.
They're all pretty much aware of that. And so am I, obviously. No, nobody wants bad data. Nobody wants to have fake memories, false memories.
Right.
That's the last thing that the person wants or that I want, you know.
Well, can that happen? Can that happen while you're hypnotizing someone?
Oh yeah, it does happen. And I'll tell the person you know, this sounded okay, and the reason I can, this sounded like it like was a real memory, and this sounded like it was a real memory, and the reason I can say that is because I might have 600 or 700 accounts of exactly what they said that's never been in the media.
Right.
And but if they say something that I've never heard before, I put that on the back burner and wait for other people to verify that kind of event without knowledge of this person's testimony. You know? So, and you can ask false questions and directly misleading questions. There's a little sort of a way in which you go about doing this kind of hypnosis, especially in the first couple of sessions, to see how vulnerable a person is and how careful you have to be and all that.
Yeah.
And but basically, it is reliable, and people say the truth. And you have to understand that a lot of people simply remember segments of the abduction phenomenon. Straight out, they don't need hypnosis.
Right.
They might not remember everything that happened, but they'll remember a significant part of what happened. And you have to take that into account as well. So if we were to take people's conscious memories and put them all together, we'd eventually get the same thing as we have with hypnosis, although not with the detail, and it would take us forever to do it.
Right. Yeah. So tell our listeners what type of information is generally garnered from a hypnosis session with an alleged alien abductee.
Well, that's a pretty big question.
Well, in a nutshell.
Well, people are taking on board an object. Usually their clothes are removed. Now, there's all sorts of, this is a complicated business, but usually that's happened, and they're put in a room where they wait, then they're brought out of the room, and they're taken into another room where there's a whole series of tables that are set up. There's people on the tables, usually. They are brought over to one table, their own table. They have to get up on it, and then there's a series of reproductive, mental, and physical procedures that are done to them. They're then taken out, and now we have a variety of other things that happen to them afterwards. They're shown unusual-looking babies, for example, that they have to hold or play with or feed. They're shown toddlers sometimes, or younger children, or older children that they have to teach something to. There's a whole variety of other things, but there's not a million things that happen. It's a variety, but it's within a narrow range.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're brought back. Their clothes are put back on. They're brought back to their normal environment, and within seconds, they have forgotten what happened. It's even coming back. By the time they come back, they've already forgotten it.
Mm. What do you attribute that to?
I'm sorry, what was that?
What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, this has been known since the very first American case, the North American case, which was the Barney and Betty Hill case, who were coming down from Montreal to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and they did not remember 2 hours of their trip to Portsmouth that happened to them, and they went to a hypnotist. Of course, nobody would... here in America, nobody there was such a thing as the abduction phenomenon.
Right.
And they went to one of the most renowned hypnotists in the country, who was the chief hypnotist for the American forces in World War II. Hmm. And he had dealt with PTSD and things like that. And he hypnotized them, and then to remember what happened in there during those 2 hours, and that's when this abduction event came about. So we know that happens, and in 1981, my friend and colleague Bud Hopkins wrote a book called Missing Time, which is one of the hallmarks, I should say, of the abduction phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a person called me up, and he and his wife were driving somewhere. They saw a flash of light. They looked at each other, and they said, "What was that? You know, what was that?"
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized that it was 2 hours later, and they were still in the car and still driving, and they were still in the same place. Now, this person happened to be a scientist, and there's two people in the car, and that just is not going to happen to people who are not abductees.
Right.
That is out of the range of human experience for people who are not abductees. But for abductees, that's standard stuff. We've heard this many, many, many times.
Now, this scientist, did he claim to be an abductee previously, or
no?
This
no,
was first
he was
time.
Telling me his experiences, and he was prominent enough for me to say that looking into these experiences was probably not good for his career.
Mm.
The problem is that the higher functioning a person, the more they have to lose, and there's nothing to gain other than knowledge of the subject for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But in every other aspect of it, it's completely negative. You have nothing to gain and everything to lose. It's a lose-lose situation.
Professional suicide to go public with this type of thing, right?
It is professional suicide, and even graduate students have come to me. And they say they want to do work, you know, in the abduction phenomenon. And I tell them to stay away from it. I tell them that you have to go into another area, you know, of history or psychology or whatever, or sociology, whatever it is that you're involved with, and work in that. And then when you get tenure at a university and you don't have any desire to be full professor, you still want to be associate professor, which means having tenure, and therefore they can't fire you.
Mm.
Then you can work in it, knowing that you'll never be full professor.
Mm.
It's a disastrous course of research for the normal academic community.
But
unfortunately,
but it's necessary. I think it's necessary. Don't you agree?
Yes, ultimately, it is necessary. And for me, you know, one does not get the opportunity to work in something of perhaps really surpassing importance very often. And I could have continued my work just strictly on anti-communism in America between 1945 and 50. But eventually the abduction phenomenon kind of took over my academic activities, and I just devoted myself to that. And I could not have done that without tenure, without job security, and without academic freedom, for which I am eternally grateful.
Right.
But the fact is that if you do that before you have tenure, you will never get tenure.
Yeah. That's the only thing that saved John Mack as well, isn't it?
John Mack was a full professor, and he had tenure. And even then, the university, Harvard University psychiatry department brought him up on not exactly charges, but there was an inquiry into what he was doing, into his agenda, into his methodology, and that sort of stuff. That was very embarrassing to him, and kind of, was almost job threatening in a sense.
Yeah.
But they couldn't get rid of him. So he continued on afterwards.
And he had
it was a heavy hit for him.
Yeah, but he had a lot of supporters too. So
he did have a lot of supporters, and he was also well known in other areas throughout North America as a leading anti-nuclear advocate, and as he had won a Pulitzer Prize in biography for a biography of Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm.
And so he had already had a major, major career before he got involved with the abduction phenomenon.
Hmm. Yeah.
So unfortunately, that did not happen to me.
Nah. I have to take just a short break here to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves in Dearborn, Michigan, out of Henry Ford Community College. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with Dr. David Jacobs. And I wanted to take a moment here to remind our listeners, or tell our listeners for the first time anyway, that on October 22nd in the Pittsburgh area, I will be speaking for MUFON Pennsylvania. And you can go to their website at MUFON PA and check that details of that for registration. Also on the bill would be Stanton Friedman and Bill Konkoleski, who's a Michigan State Director. And he's been on the show. Both of them been on the show before. So I'm kind of proud to be able to share the stage with them and many others. Bill Burns of UFO Hunters will be on the stage too. Also on October 15th in the Philadelphia area, Linda Moulton Howe of earthfiles.com. She'll be, in fact, she's going to be our guest next month. And Bill Burns of UFO Hunters, many more. That's the 15th, but I will be in Pittsburgh on October 22nd. And the State Director of Pennsylvania MUFON, John Ventra, will be speaking at both conferences. And John will also be our guest on this show in October, on the October edition of We Are Not Alone. So go to MUFON PA, that's MUFONPA.com, and click on the conference registration button for the complete speaker lineup and our registration information. So, I hope to see you in Pittsburgh. Dr. Jacobs, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And when you do these abduction hypnosis sessions on alleged abductees, do you also do a routine psychological evaluation of them?
Well, what I do is I have them fill out a questionnaire. And if I decide to go forward with the questionnaire, I have them call me, and then we go through the questions. I wind up talking with them for a couple of hours to see whether they are mentally stable or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because during that time, usually if they're not, something will come out that will attract my attention as a person who I don't want coming to my home office. every once in a while, somebody will slip through, I must say. I then give them all the warnings, the pros and the cons of finding out about this, and stressing the cons quite heavily.
Which are what?
The cons are that once they find out something is happening to them and has been happening to them since they were born, basically, and it's the abduction phenomenon, that once they have that knowledge, everything changes, and they can never go back. It's once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get it back in again. It is opening up a Pandora's box, and do they really want to do it? And some people get depressed afterwards, after the first few sessions, they realize, oh, my God, this is actually happening.
Hmm.
Some people feel isolated. They want to tell everybody, and then they can't because people think they're crazy.
Right.
And there's a series of other problems that might happen to them. And so I stress that. And then they have to call me back after a few more days, and they have to consult with their husband or their wife or their best friend or whatever it is, and somebody who they can trust as to whether they should actually do this. And I managed to get about a third of them to drop out right then and there. And so the ones who are really sort of committed to it will stay. And even at that, only about 25% of those will just drop out after one session with me, or maybe two sessions, and that's it.
After they start remembering what happened, right?
Yeah, it becomes too frightening to them, and they realize, God, this really is something that is powerful and can affect me, and they get scared, and that's fine with me. I don't charge any money for anything I do, and anybody can drop out at any time, and so that's okay. So most people stay for, a lot of people stay for the duration, which is as long as they want. Some people will drop out after 6 sessions or 10 sessions or whatever. Some people stay for 20, 30, 40, you know.
Hmm. And you find that most of your clients have been abductees since childhood?
Right. Now, you have to remember that they've gotten this questionnaire, and they've already talked with me for hours about their experiences.
Hmm.
So abductees have a series of experiences that they'll say, my first experience was when I was 16, or they'll say the first experience was when I was 12, or I remember something happened to me when I was 6. And each one of those cases means automatically, from what I've learned, is that what they're actually saying is that I just don't remember things that have happened to me because I forgot them a few seconds afterwards and never remembered again. But there are some bleed-through memories that I remember consciously. And the earliest bleed-through memory I have is when I was 7 or 10 or 12 or something like that. And people have told me that the first abduction that ever happened to them was when they were an adult. And we've just never seen that. That's just not part of this phenomenon. And the reason we know it starts in infancy is because all abductees have one thing in common, and that is that their mother or their father or both were abductees themselves.
Hmm.
And abductees are abducted with their babies.
Yeah.
So that's how we know it happens in infancy, obviously, because the adults tell us.
It might be very hard to substantiate, but is it possible that the abductions in the family lineage goes back and back and back to grandparents, great-grandparents, before we even, before the modern UFO era, which we seem to have date-stamped in 1947.
That is correct, and that's why I say that in 1947 the UFO phenomenon first came to public attention,
mm-hmm.
not that it first began.
No.
But the thing is that Bud Hopkins first discovered that it was intergenerational, and we had this, we haven't seen any exceptions to this, really. Sometimes there's abductions of opportunity where a person is abducted in a car, and they're the abductee, and the other people are just sort of switched off, and they'll just sort of be out of it in the car while the car itself is taken up. Technically speaking, that's an abduction, but it really, they don't go through the procedures and all that. So, but for regular abductees, they're all intergenerational, and the question is, if their mother or their father was an abductee, then what about their grandparents, you know, and, and usually there's a grandparent who was an abductee, too, and then what about his, those people's parents, and we can date this phenomenon backwards like that to about the 1880s. And through family lore and through the grandfathers of elderly people who told them stories and that sort of thing, that sort of stuff. So we can date it back to the last quarter of the 19th century with a certain degree of credibility, with a certain degree of validity. But after that, we lose sight of it totally. And my sense is that it started then, it started relatively small and has grown throughout the society. Because if an if an abductee marries a non-abductee and they have children, most likely the children will be abductees also, and I mean all of them. Now, people, some people say, no, it's just a few of them, not necessarily all of them that will be abductees. But in my experience, it's all of them. And so so it spreads out laterally throughout the society, grows like a cone, and it spreads out longitudinally. Vertically, let's just say, through the generations. So the question then is, if that's what's happening, how many generations will it take for everybody in the entire world, you know, to be an abductee, or let's just say everybody in America? And I had a PhD mathematician actually look at this and work on it for me, and of course it depends on how many people the phenomenon began with. And he said anywhere from 7 to 10 generations or something like that. You know, that's a pretty good number. So the point is, if this phenomenon started with the Egyptians in 3000 B.C., by 1000 or 2000 B.C., everybody in the country and in the world would have been an abductee already. You see what I mean? It's, as it just grows that way. And if it started in you know, in the 15th century, by the 17th century, everybody would be an abductee. So we know that that only about 5% of the American public is might be abductees, and so we can, and that number actually goes along with the last quarter of the 19th century in terms of how old the phenomenon is. Now, I have investigated cases from the 30s, others have investigated cases from the 20s, and we have accounts of cases, in my opinion, from the teens as well. So we know that it didn't start in 1947, let's put it that way.
Well, you know, using that logic, the old myths and lore of in Ireland of the leprechauns, the little people that would steal the children in the middle of the night, isn't it possible that those were alien abductions, but they just saw them that way and started the rumors or the stories about leprechauns and.
Well, anything is possible, and the thing about the abduction phenomenon is that if you look hard enough, you're going to find parallels to pieces of it here, there, and everywhere in folklore and popular culture, you know, movies, television, whatever. But we have to be very careful here that we don't that similarity does not become equality. That because things are similar, you know, leprechauns and elves and trolls and this and that. That and stealing children or shifting or whatever it is, that is I'm sorry, evidence of the abduction phenomenon itself. My guess is that it's not, to tell you the truth. It just doesn't work that way. It works that way in folklore, but this phenomenon doesn't work that way. It's not folkloric in any way. And it is, we know that it's a global phenomenon. And you know, perhaps you know, we have the same kinds of accounts in other countries too. But they usually fit the society in which they're from. So anything past the late 19th century, and when people try to make these similar stories and folklore into the abduction phenomenon, I just to me the evidence is never holds up very well.
And you mentioned earlier that some of your these abductees recall consciously their experience. What percentage of your clients has conscious recall?
Right. I don't know, but probably around 20%.
Really?
Yeah. And what they remember, they'll remember if the abduction phenomenon goes from A to Z, that is to say, A being something is wrong, I feel like I can't move, I'm sitting on the couch watching television, what's going on? To B, people are coming into my room, to C, I'm beginning to float up, or to D, I'm going out the window, you know, that sort of stuff. Mm. What people will remember is A, something was wrong, B, I think I see somebody in my room, I interpret it as ghosts, because that's what the society allows me to interpret it as, or I see a religious figure because that's what the society allows me to interpret it as, and then suddenly I'm back on the couch. They zoom all the way to Z, and they say suddenly I find myself back on the couch, and I know that that was a religious event for me, and it's been profound, and it shaped my life, and this and that, and or they'll remember A, or they'll go right to, let's just say, to G. They're lying on a table. That's what they remember. They thought they were in a hospital or something, but there were little people around them, and it was really weird. And then they'll remember C, and then they'll remember a totally screwed up version of Q, and then they'll remember something about L that's at the end, but it's not. And then they'll fit it together into a narrative, and they'll tell me, this is what happened to me. I remember it like yesterday, and this happened exactly the way I said it. And the way I handle that usually is saying, well, that's extremely interesting, and you might be absolutely right on target, but let's take a look at it and see. And then when they begin to remember it, they remember, oh, something else happened here. I forgot about that. Oh, yeah. Mm. And then they start going A, B, C, and they realize they were out of sequence, and they put it together in a chronological way, the way everybody else puts it together, even though they were heavily committed to that story in the first place. You see what I mean? Right. And they realize themselves, as I ask them what happens next, and then what happens, you know, they realize they were wrong. Mm. Not that it's, I mean, being wrong might have made for a more interesting story, actually, but they just tell me the standard abduction events that happen, usually.
Right.
And, so people will remember, but you have to be careful. Now, some people will remember segments that are just dead on perfect, just absolutely correct, that have no problems whatsoever. It's unusual, I must say. It is unusual. More than likely, they remember bits and pieces of things.
Mm-hmm. So what about this when the skeptic says sleep paralysis? That is the typical explanation from skeptics. It's sleep paralysis.
Yeah, well, the first thing that happens is my eyes roll back in my head. because this has been, you know, the sleep paralysis phenomenon was first developed by a professor at Penn State University named David Hufford, who gave a talk on it at a 1992 MIT conference on abductions. And it was ridiculous in 1992, and then the UFO community and the abduction community totally squashed that with just reality, and then everybody forgot about it. But because
they're still using it,
don't have any knowledge of the history of the phenomenon, and they don't have any knowledge of the debates about the phenomenon, it's come back as if it's a new theory. And led by a woman named Susan Clancy and other people, and it's from Harvard where she was, and so that was all the rage within the last couple of years, although it's dying down now. And the reason is this: the majority of cases that I have looked at, now it's a close majority, but the majority of cases that I have looked at took place when the person was not asleep or in bed.
Bud Hopkins had that anticipated the sleep paralysis thing when he was being interviewed for that special, Jennings special, Seeing is Believing, and he had that prepared, but of course after 8 hours of interviewing, all of that explanation that on sleep paralysis and poo-pooing sleep paralysis was on the editor's floor.
Right, that's exactly right, and that happened for a Discovery Channel, show which I was on as well, and I think I was on it. I never saw it actually, but I remember them coming down and interviewing me anyway. But that was in those days when sleep paralysis had reared its ugly head. Mm-hmm. People are abducted in cars, they're abducted in groups, they're abducted in their backyard in the middle of the day, they're abducted while they're watching television, they're abducted all over the place, and they are abducted when they're asleep. Now, the thing is that they're abducted when they're going to be missed the least, which is why they're not abducted by and large, although there are cases where this has happened, but by and large, they're not abducted in the workplace.
Mm.
And because then they would, in fact, be missed, but I have cases when they are. And so the time when you're going to be missed the least is when you're at home in bed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people are laying in bed and they're watching television.
So this
some people
is...
are listening to or are reading or listening to the radio, whatever it is, and they're not asleep and they're abducted. And some people just are plain asleep. That's a significant number of people. But you cannot paint the whole thing as happening because of sleep paralysis. Now, we know quite a lot about sleep paralysis, and we know what people sort of remember in sleep paralysis. And they'll remember a feeling of floating. They'll remember being paralyzed. They'll remember seeing figures. Maybe they'll remember seeing a light in their room or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you're dealing with there is in the abduction phenomenon, you're dealing with the letter A. You know what I mean?
No.
Most of those people aren't abductees, and they don't know what happens to abductees. They don't know B, C, D, E, L, A, to Z.
That's right. That is right. I know one woman in particular. She has had no clue about what would happen to an abductee. She would... it was totally, a total skeptic on the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And yet all these things were happening throughout her life. And then when she found out about a few things about the abduction phenomenon, she said, whoa, wait a minute. Why is this happening? Why is the same thing happening to me? And she found out she was an abductee. I have to take one more break here just to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Dr. David Jacobs, author of The Threat and many other books, and he is a hypnotist and mostly of alien abductees. And have you ever... Dr. Jacobs, have you ever had someone try to fake it just to, in an effort to discredit you?
That has happened so rarely that it has not happened to me.
No.
And it's not happened to Bud Hopkins, but it did happen to John Mack.
Right.
And it happened to another researcher in Connecticut. And both those, the researcher in Connecticut had a writer who wanted to write an article about the subject and wasn't an abductee. And the researcher found him out immediately, actually. They were saying things that were totally nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
But John Mack did not understand that this woman he had hired to work for his organization that he had for abduction research was also... a person who was faking it, and she was doing it just to sort of, for reasons that I don't fully understand, to discredit him. And those are the two cases we can look at. Now, we've had people who said things that that were not true, and maybe they were pathological liars, but they weren't done to discredit anybody. and Bud Hopkins found a person like that once. I haven't found anybody like that yet, but then again, I've only worked with about 150 people.
That's a good cross-section, I think.
What's that?
That's a good cross-section, I think.
Well, you know, Bud has... I work with him for years and years and years, for decades even. And Bud works with him much less, but he has a much wider spread of people whom he's worked with. So he has more of a chance of running into that. But so far, so good for me. But it is rare. It's so rare. It's really is statistically insignificant. Because why would anybody come to our homes and just lie? For what gain? What do they get out of it?
Maybe you're getting too close to the truth.
Most people just want to find out what in the dickens has been happening to them since they were a kid. They've had very strange lives. Their friends don't have these kind of strange lives. They've seen unusual things, unusual lights in their room. They've had missing time experiences. They've had fears of places like a stretch of road. Who in their right mind would be afraid of a stretch of road that they've driven through 1,000 times and then suddenly they're scared to death of it? You know, things like that. And this is abduction life. Whereas people that are not abductees just don't have those kinds of experiences. Maybe one or two, but not that they don't add up to a whole lifetime of experiences.
So what do you think the agenda is of the aliens? What's the purpose of all this?
Well, here comes the crazy stuff.
Okay. Like we haven't done crazy stuff so far?
No.
Okay.
We've been eminently sane. Okay. Now craziness creeps in.
Okay.
Well, you know, when I first got into this back in 82 and started doing hypnosis in 86, I still had the model of Barney and Betty Hill. This was some sort of a learning situation. They were studying us. There was something about us that they needed that they wanted, perhaps, or whatever it was. And when I wrote Secret Life in 1992, I held to that model throughout that book. I couldn't figure out what in the dickens this whole darn thing was about. And by the time I wrote The Threat in 97 and all that, I think I had figured it out, because by that time, well, I partially figured it out, that is to say. By that time, I had come across a whole series of events where people would be taken into a room and they would be shown a screen or a screen-like device. Let's just say that was part of the wall. And there might be one abductee and there might be a bunch of abductees there, all slack-jawed, glassy-eyed, unable to move, passive. When abductees look at each other, they always say, you know, that guy who's coming towards me looks like a zombie. But if you actually ever got a hold of that guy and he sees the woman who I've been working with, the guy is thinking to himself, gee, look at that woman. She looks like a zombie. So, yeah, that's the word that's most used when people describe other people that they see. But because they're so passive.
You mean
shuffling along.
When they see them on the ship.
What's that?
When they see them on the ship.
When they see them on the ship, right, walking down a hallway, past them, towards them, and past them, and that sort of thing. Or standing in a room, looking at these screens. And on the screen, there'll be, let's just say, and this is an actual event, a barbecue. It's just a standard picnic. And there's people standing around a grill, and they're making hot dogs or hamburgers or whatever it is, and there's people playing ball, and it means a couple of people who are, talking to each other and whatever. You know, just a standard picnic, just a... of no consequence whatsoever. And now, before I even say the next sentence that they're told, I have to back up here and give people a sense that this is a reproductively oriented phenomenon. Sperm is taken, eggs are taken, fetuses are implanted in women, and fetuses are extracted from women. Now, and this we have known from early on, from the early 80s, when Hopkins first discovered this, to everyone's amazement.
Right.
And what this we didn't know what this meant. People would be shown babies that looked like they were half alien, half human. They would be shown babies that looked like they were more human than young people who were more alien. I mean, and then it went on that they were seeing more and more of these young people who looked more and more human. Mm. And pretty soon, they looked sort of human. And then eventually, it looked quite human. And then eventually, they looked just plain human. Now, they don't know when they describe this to me that other people are saying the same thing and that it's going on in time, that this has changed over time. They shouldn't all be saying this at the same time. You see what I mean?
This was evolution chronologically.
This is evolutionary chronologically. That's right.
Okay.
So so they'll look at the screen with the picnic, and they'll hear, you know, all communication with standard gray aliens is telepathic. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, can you tell the difference between you and us?
Hmm.
And the person will look at the screen and say, huh? What do you mean? There's no difference. Everybody looks the same to me, you know.
Hmm.
And they'll say, see, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? Soon we will all be together. Soon we will all be happy. Soon everyone will know his place.
Wow.
And, you know, when you hear that for the first time, you just put it on the back burner, you wait for other people to say the same thing, and other people began to say the same thing. And then more began to say it, and then the aliens began to say it. Soon we'll all be together. Everybody's going to be happy. It's just going to be wonderful.
Hmm.
And you hear that enough times, and eventually it's evidence. You know, this is what people are saying.
Hmm.
And they didn't used to say this years and years ago, but now they're saying that.
Where will we all be together?
Yeah, soon we'll all be. Now, first I thought, well, maybe we'll all be together on the planet Vortex, or something, you know,
or Melmac,
right? but it was clear that it was going to be Earth, like the picnic scene, you know.
Wow.
And since that time, this has grown and grown and grown, and people have described more and more of this sort of hybrid interaction. Hybrids being these, you know, cross between humans and aliens, depending on whether they're more alien and also depending on whether they're more human,
right,
in terms of what their tasks are. But they have been doing now a lot of the abduction work. People report the aliens, and, you know, they still report aliens all the time, but they also report hybrids doing this kind of abduction work in much, much, much greater frequency than in the 1980s, or that when things that happened to them in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and all that. And so the question is, why is this happening? And then I began to hear stories about hybrids coming down and being taught things here on Earth, how to shop at a store, how to make change, you know, go to the cash register, you give them the money. You have to, they'll say something to you, you have to respond, then you have to wait for your change, and then you put your change back in your pocket, and then you take your whatever you bought and leave, and things like that. Taught them how to shop in a market and
the
cart. And
the abductee, like the abductees are teaching these aliens.
Correct.
How to be human.
How to be human, exactly. How to be human. That's exactly the phrase. And eventually, you know, I've heard so much of this now that I do think that this is an integration program into the society, and it's global, and it's there's an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount of energy behind it, and it's a very, very, very serious situation, and the difference between them and us, it's not just that they're humans, and there's just going to be more illegal immigrants or something like that. It's that these people can control humans neurologically from a distance. In other words, there is no abduction phenomenon without the ability to control humans neurologically.
Yeah.
When a person is sitting in their living room watching Jay Leno or David Letterman or whoever, and they realize something is wrong. Why can't I get up? And there's people coming into my room, and I'm scared. And why, you know? And they can't. They find they can't move. And then they're helped out of bed, and they walk slowly to the wall or to the window, and they go right through the closed window and all that. They they have to be controlled, because if they realize something is wrong, they just reach behind their pillow, get out their .357 Magnum, and blow them away.
Yes, and I think the visitors know that, too. I mean, I know they know that.
They would get up and run. They'd call 911, whatever it is that they would do. Nobody wants people in their room late at night,
right,
or pulling off to the side of the road and somebody else opening the car door and you getting out while a UFO waits off to the side. Nobody wants that. So everybody has to be neurologically controlled. Now, the thing about the hybrids who would be integrating into the society, if this is an integration program, is that they can control people too. And that makes us not second-class citizens. That makes us a second-class species.
Yeah, yeah.
And whereas I started investigating this subject years and years ago with a lot of enthusiasm and amazement and all sorts of questions and answers and this and that, and I learned a lot about it, now I don't like it so much anymore. Now it scares me. I'm very, very unnerved by the whole thing.
When you look at it that way, but there are many abductees who feel that the visitor's purpose is benign and even benevolent.
Right, and that's what's called incompetent hypnosis. That's in my opinion.
Hmm.
I have never had that.
Really?
Never.
Even from those.
I have this fantasy that I know what I'm doing.
Even from those who recall consciously their abduction experience?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, all they know is what happened to them. They don't know whether it's benign or not. But people who think it's benign, I've had people think it's wonderful, it's great, and it's loving, and they're kind, and they're terrific, and I love them, and they love me, and it's a love fest and all the rest of that stuff.
Mm.
And they get down here in the room I'm sitting in right now, in fact, and lay on my little couch here, and then they begin to remember what happened to them, and none of that stuff comes out.
Really?
I had one woman who had a couple of sessions with me, and she was heavily, heavily, I cannot underemphasize this, or actually I can't overemphasize it, maybe I am underemphasizing it, but she was heavily into the world of New Age and the world of benign, benevolent, cancer-curing, war-stopping aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And in the two sessions we had, she did not remember anything of the sort like that. It was just standard stuff. And then she wrote me a letter saying to me that she hadn't remembered what she wanted to remember, and therefore was my fault. And the answer is, look, I would prefer to have benign, benevolent aliens.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. I'd jump for joy. I've got no stake in this, you know. So, but she didn't. She just remembered what everybody else did.
She wanted you to lead her and into on the garden path, so to speak.
Well, she felt that I had let her off the garden path by asking the supercharged question, what happens next?
What happens next? Yeah. Wow. That'd be a good title for a book, What Happens Next.
Gee, that's not a bad title. I like that.
Okay, I get royalties. Just kidding.
Well, but, so am I.
So you think that their purpose then is a threat, just like your book,
right?
The threat.
And, you know, and that's the jackpot question with abduction research. Why are they doing this?
Mm-hmm.
What is the purpose of an integration into the society?
Mm.
Why do this at all? What's the point? And we do not know that. We just don't know that.
Hmm.
The gray alien types or whatever, they don't say it, and I don't think that the hybrids know. I think that this is information that has been withheld from them also. Their job is to live here, period.
Is to live here.
Yeah, so the reason why, that jackpot question, we simply don't know, and I don't know if we're going to know it until after this thing happens, if it does, and if I'm right. And this is one of those situations where I hope to God that I'm wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be right. I've got young adults who are kids of mine, and they got their lives to lead. You know, I want to be wrong. That would be fine with me. I'll be happy to stand there with egg on my face and everybody pointing and laughing at me for being an idiot.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'll be an idiot. Okay.
David Jacobs, where can people go to check out your work?
Well, I have a website called www.ufoabduction.com. That's singular abduction as opposed to plural. If you type in plural abductions, then it's a whole other world. Not my world, but if you just in singles, in singular, ufoabduction.com, and that's about it.
Very good. And check out his books there and everything else. And very good work so far, Dr. Jacobs, Dr. David Jacobs. And I wish you continued success. And I do hope you're wrong about that, that threat.
You and I are in agreement.
But just in case, well, what can I say? And thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Jacobs.
Thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
Okay. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived on my website, ufoimplications.com. Now, please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Hey, this is Brian Vander Ark, and you're listening to my music on WHFR Dearborn.
Night, bitter.